Let's open our Bibles, if you would, to Acts chapter 23. We have a lot to discuss this morning from this chapter, Acts chapter 23. I know that you have read this text time and time and time again, and it is forever relevant. I want you to note, however, in this portion of our study, especially the 23rd chapter, going forward for a few chapters, what we're reading is simply a narrative of events as they occur. And so we want to note some things along the way and familiarize ourselves once again with the narrative. All right, Acts 22, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Now, James, you're fortunate you're back there. The audience can't hear you. But to get to the narrative itself and the order of the events, Acts 21, Paul is arrested. Eve, you're on deck. Take it from there. Acts 22, what takes place? Paul before the Jewish people. Then 23, before the Jewish court, the Sanhedrin. 24, before the Roman authority, Felix, and then Felix goes out of office and leaves Paul in prison to appear before his replacement, who was Festus, and then King Agrippa. And at that point, Paul has appealed his case to go to Rome, so he will appear before Caesar. And it's at that point, as we conclude the book of Acts, that Paul is in Rome and in prison. And we don't know from the book of Acts what occurs from there. But in our study of Acts 23... we know that Claudius Lysias has arrested Paul, and as the course of events take place, it would certainly be appropriate for him to bring him before the Jewish court, and that's what we're discussing in Acts chapter 23. And as Claudius Lysias takes him before the Jewish court, the purpose is to ascertain what he's guilty of. Now, we know that he has been arrested by Claudius Lysias in Acts 21 because of this great, what we would call mob violence. The apostle is about to be torn apart because of his presence and accusations that have been made there in Acts chapter 21, teaching that men were to forsake the law of Moses wasn't true. Teaching men not to circumcise their children wasn't true. And taking a Gentile, Trophimus, into the temple wasn't true. These are all false accusations. But the better part of this mob really doesn't understand why all this is happening. And certainly Claudius Lysias, in the position that he's in, to be a peacekeeper in the city of Jerusalem, has arrested him now for his own protection. And these accusations need to be established or ascertained, so Paul is taken before the Jewish court. Now, in a couple of studies ago, Richard presented that there were actually 71 people that made up this high court, counting the high priest. But this high court is divided, and I want to pick up the reading for just a moment. They're beginning in verse 6. Now, we notice the exchange between the people, the court, the high priest, as it were, Ananias, and the apostle Paul. The high priest has ordered that Paul be smitten, and we know that Paul has rebuked him, essentially calling him a hypocrite. We talked about verse 3, "Thou whited wall, and sittest thou to judge me against according to the law and commandments, commandest me to be smitten contrary to the law." He calls him a hypocrite. Now, he didn't know that he was the high priest, and so Paul stands corrected on that count by those round about. We discussed why Paul perhaps did not recognize or know him to be the high priest. But I do want to reiterate this one point in verse 5. Paul said, "It is written, thou shalt not speak evil of the ruler of thy people." Paul knows the law. He knows what it says, and he quotes it here in this instance, as he does on a number of occasions. But then in verse 6, when Paul perceived that the one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, touching the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question." Now, Paul does not mince words about what he's been preaching. He identifies himself with the Pharisees, and certainly you see that there was a political advantage to doing that because the court itself was divided. Sadducees and Pharisees. Now, we've talked about the differences between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, and you can elaborate on that till the cows come home and talk about the various groups among the Jews and their differences and their likenesses and the conflicts that existed between them. But for our purposes, we want to note that the Pharisees believed in the resurrection. They believed in angels. They believed in rank among the angels. And we also note that the Sadducees simply did not. Now, we've talked about that and cited passages to illustrate that, particularly as the Sadducees questioned Jesus in Matthew chapter 22. Of course, denying that there was a resurrection, they ask him a question relative to the resurrection, which establishes their hypocrisy. But be that as it may, what I want you to note here is that the Apostle Paul says that touching the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. Now, was he right or wrong? Was that why he had been questioned? Well, in principle, yes. Yes.
Now,
That's right. He's preaching that Jesus was raised from the dead. And if Jesus was raised from the dead, then that means that we will be raised from the dead. And it also implies that we have the opportunity for forgiveness of sins through the blood of Jesus. So yes, when Paul said, I am called in question regarding hope and the resurrection of the dead, that's exactly why he's been arrested. Now, if you'll note in chapter 24, reading beginning in verse 21, now I know that's jumping ahead just a little bit, but if you'll note his defense in Acts chapter 24 in verse 21, there the text tells us, well, begin at verse 20, or else let these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question before you this day. Now, Paul's just relating exactly what he had said. Acts chapter 24, verse 21. Keep in mind, in that instance, he's before 24, before Felix. That's right, before Felix. And he's telling the governor that these Jews, if they want to accuse me, let them establish what crime I've committed, except this one thing that I preached, that there is a resurrection from the dead. And he did. You read that here before the Jewish council in Acts chapter 23.
I meant to ask this last week, but we ran out of time. When we say that the Pharisees believed in the resurrection, what exactly does that mean? The Pharisaic understanding of the law, did they just look at, Psalm 16, he will not allow his Holy One to undergo decay? Did they look at that and say, well, there must be a resurrection then? Or where in the Old Testament did they get the idea that there will be a general resurrection?
Well, there are several places. For example, you can go back as far as Abraham, Job, made statements that indicates that these men believed that there was a resurrection. In fact, in the New Testament, comment made relative to Abraham, and I've heard this before, some say, well, Abraham didn't have much of a concept of life after death. I deny that, because the text tells us regarding the faith of Abraham that he dwelt in a land that was not his own, but he looked for a city which hath foundation, whose builder and maker is God. He had some kind of a concept of life after death. And if you read further in that very text, it says in verse 13, these all died in faith, and not having received the promises, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Now, what is a pilgrim? I'm in Hebrews 11. Verse 13, they confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Well, what is a pilgrim? It's somebody that's journeying to something else. And in the next verse, it becomes evident. He says, verse 14, for they that say such things make it manifest that they are seeking after a country of their own. Now, what was Abraham looking for? Something that God was the author of, the builder and founder of, something that was permanent. Abraham was looking for a house or a city that has foundation. I'm convinced Abraham was looking towards something better than this earth.
We don't have a scriptural reference where God told him that.
No. It's not recorded for us, but neither is every conversation that God had with Abraham.
And I wish I had a better memory that But it is sprinkled throughout minor prophets, prophets. It's sprinkled throughout the Old Testament. Isaiah 24, for instance, talks about a judgment on the whole earth.
And yes.
If there's no life after death, then really, what's that talking about? Is that just God going to destroy the earth and that's it? Nothing more after that?
Right. These men had some reason for serving God. They believed what God said about this life and the promise of something better. Yes, that's true. And of course, Job's comments in Job chapter 14, he asked the question, if a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my warfare would I wait till I release, my release should come. Thou wouldest call and I wouldest answer. Thou wouldest have a desire to the work of thy hands. And then later in chapter 19, he said in verse 25, but as for me, I know that my Redeemer liveth. And I don't believe he's talking about Jesus in that text, but be that as it may. He said, and at last he will stand upon the earth. Now again, I don't believe that he's talking about a temporal earthly kingdom of Jesus coming to the earth. The marginal note is he shall stand upon the dust. That is, he would stand in victory on my remains. But it says, and after my skin, even this body is destroyed, then without my flesh shall I see God. Now, what was it that Job anticipated? Was it all just here and now? Or did he have some anticipation of life after death?
I'm not answering my question.
So there are a number of passages.
So the Sadducees basically just denied all the sprinkling, as Rainer was saying.
Well, the Sadducees denied that. But the Pharisees denied a whole lot, too, about the coming of Jesus. So as far as Old Testament prophecies were concerned, the leaders of the Jews rejected a lot of Old Testament prophecies as being fulfilled in Jesus. Yeah.
And one other point. After Jesus had been raised from the dead, he goes to Emmaus with the two disciples.
Yes.
He comes back. It says there in Luke 24, I think it is, it says that Jesus explained to the disciples that the Messiah must suffer and die and be raised from the dead, and he did this from the prophets and the Psalms.
Well, that's right. And of course, those men had some perception of Jesus being raised from the dead because they had heard that he had preached that on the third day he would be raised from the dead, and they affirmed it is the third day. Yes, Eve and then Becky, please.
Well, but, you know, in 6 where he says this, I'm on trial for the, which obviously I agree with, but there was more to it than that.
You know? Oh, yeah.
I mean, they just had a general hatred and felt really threatened, you know, by what he was teaching and what was being taught to lots of people.
Well, that's right. They hated what he was preaching. Because think about it, Eve. If what Paul is saying about who Jesus is true, what does that do to this Jewish court? What does that do to this multitude of Jews that have said in the city of Jerusalem when Jesus came in and they first said, Hosanna, praise God, he's the king, going to be like it was. And then just within a day, they said, crucify him, crucify him. You see, they're being indicted for the crucifixion of the Messiah. If what Paul says is true.
Going further in Hebrews 11, with reference to the offering of Isaac, verse 19, it specifically says, he, that is Abraham, considered that God is able to raise people even from the dead.
That's right.
So it specifically tells us that Abraham believed in a resurrection from the dead.
That's right. And if it be immediate or if it be down the pike somewhere, he can still do it.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. All right, very good comments. Any other questions or comments on that? Very crucial. But I think the point, to return back to verse 6 of our text, Acts 23, Paul is affirming to this council that I have preached hope and I have preached the resurrection of the dead. And for that cause, I am called in question. And, of course, when you identify those two elements, that expands the spectrum to include everything that he had said about who Jesus is. Because Paul, writing in the Roman letter in chapter 1, verse 4, identifies the resurrection as the hinge pin of evidence that Jesus is the Christ. He was raised from the dead. And how many times did Paul preach that? Over and over and over and over. And of course, that was the substance of the preaching all the way from Acts 2, that God had raised Jesus from the dead, and that had created difficulty in the minds of the Sadducees from the get-go. Look, if you will, and I like to do this every once in a while. You've heard it before in sermons that I've preached in Bible classes, but when you go back in Acts chapter 2, 3, 4, and 5, look at what the substance of the preaching is. It's repeated over and over. The same thing in Acts 2, verse 36. Let all the house of Israel therefore know assuredly that God hath made him both Lord and Christ, this Jesus whom ye crucified. Well, how had he been established to be Lord and Christ? Peter's sermon is that he's exalted at the right hand of God. God raised him from the dead, and we are all witnesses. So here you see it first introduced in Acts chapter 2 by the preaching of the apostles. As Peter presents it on this occasion. And then when you drop on down into the third chapter, you see the same thing in verse 13. He said, "The God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, the God of our fathers, hath glorified his servant Jesus, whom you delivered up and denied before the face of Pilate when he was determined to release him. But ye denied the holy and righteous one and asked for a murderer to be granted unto you and killed the Prince of Life, whom God raised from the dead, whereof we are witnesses." And you see it again in the fourth chapter there, beginning in verse 8, the same thing. And then again in the fifth chapter, you see the same thing presented. So this becomes the substance of the preaching of the apostles from the beginning. You can just follow that theme through the book of Acts. So when Paul said, "I'm in trouble because I preach there's hope in the resurrection," you see why then that he's called into question.
I'm just going to add the Athenians, when he says, he wraps it up in Acts 17 and 31, "He fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he has appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead."
That's right. That's right. And 1 Corinthians 15. I mean, there's a whole laundry list of passages that indicate the preaching of the apostles during New Testament times was that there is a resurrection, specifically in the book of Acts, over and over again. Yeah. All right. Now, having introduced that, you see then why that this would create difficulty between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And the irony, I suppose, of that is that it divides the assembly yet more. If you look at verse 7, it says, "And when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided." Now, I dare say, this is probably a speculation on my part, but this is probably not the first discussion that has been on the subject of the resurrection between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, especially in this Jewish court. So Paul extracts from this already existent division this valid point. Now, we've noted, and Randy Childs, in reference to your question, we've noted some Old Testament passages that indicate that there would be a resurrection. We can cite a number of passages in the New Testament during the time or ministry of Jesus. For example, as early as John chapter 5, you remember in verses 28 and 29, Jesus presents there evidence that there's going to be a resurrection and a judgment of those who are righteous and those who are unrighteous. And then you will also note that in John chapter 11, Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. But in the discussion there between Jesus and Lazarus' sisters, indicating that Lazarus will live again, their perception was, "We know that in the resurrection he'll be raised from the dead." That wasn't what Jesus was talking about. Jesus was talking about raising him from the dead right then. But their knowledge of a general resurrection indicates that it had been taught and accepted as true, that there would be a general resurrection. And so we see in the Old Testament, during the ministry of Jesus, during the preaching of the apostles, this becomes the theme. Now, in reference to that point, Randy, again, Childs, as you pointed out from Acts chapter 17, in verses 30 and 31, the very fact that Jesus was raised from the dead becomes our assurance, our guarantee that we too will be raised from the dead. So all of this goes back from what had been taught in essentially the beginning. Our hope is in the fact that there is a resurrection. Now, go ahead.
Romans 1:4.
Yes, the verifying of who Jesus is, the hinge pin point, as we mentioned, is that Jesus was raised from the dead. Now, Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, that chapter, whole chapter, is to be identified with the general theme of the resurrection. The whole chapter. And you'll note that Paul begins there in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 12. How say some among you that there is no resurrection of the dead? You see. How do you say that? Because you see, if there is no resurrection of the dead, then Jesus was not raised from the dead. But what was the theme of the preaching of all the apostles? That he was raised from the dead. But if he was not raised from the dead, then our preaching is vain, and your faith is vain, and we are yet in our sins. We don't have any hope. So you see the consequences of that. That thing just snowballs. So this becomes the hinge pin of our hope, the hinge pin of our salvation, that Jesus was raised from the dead. So you see why this was such an issue. If the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection, and neither the Sadducees nor the Pharisees believed that Jesus was the Messiah, and here you have these men teaching that he is the Messiah, proven to be so, in that he was raised from the dead, that demands accountability. Don't we see that? And it demands accountability of them, as well as us. They would answer for the things that they're doing. And so these two groups, as you see on the board, they clamored with each other over the things that Paul has been teaching, and certainly over whether or not he is subject to be penalized by the court because he's teaching something that some of them, in fact, if we get the overall picture, all of them did not believe. The Sadducees believed in the resurrection, but did they believe that Jesus was the Christ? I didn't say that right, did I? The Pharisees believed in the resurrection, but did they believe that Jesus was the Christ? Well, no. And the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. Did they believe Jesus was the Christ? No. So you see the point. So here they're fussing about that among themselves. That's a poor word, poor choice of words on my part. They were doing more than fussing. And the reason we want to note that is, if you'll note in Acts chapter 4, this had been their position from the beginning. In verse 1, it says, "And as they spake unto the people, the priest and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them, being sore troubled, because they taught the people and proclaimed in Jesus the resurrection from the dead." And you'll notice in verse 3, they laid hands on them and put them in jail, you see, because they didn't believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, didn't believe that he was the Messiah. And so these men, no matter how many of them there were, saying, "We saw him," didn't do it for them. Makes you wonder.
Why didn't they mess with their deal?
No, that's right. Didn't want them messing up what they had. They had a position of power, clout, money, prestige.
And he came so that they would be nothing.
That's why they killed him.
I'm wondering why Paul would all of a sudden make this declaration.
Well, I think twofold. One is, and why make it in chapter 24 again? I think, again, twofold. One is, it provides him with an opportunity to extract or exploit this division that exists in the court, which is, as we mentioned a moment ago, politically to his advantage. But I think that's small potatoes in comparison to his overall scheme. His overall scheme is to use this opportunity, or as an opportunity, to preach who Jesus is. He's been doing that, and he doesn't stop doing that.
Well, he doesn't. I think that what's happened is he's walked in. It's Claudius is the one that's put this meeting together.
True.
His idea. And I think he's figured out, based on the first couple of events, that this wasn't going to end well.
Well, he knew when he came to Jerusalem it wasn't going to end well.
Well, but I'm saying that this particular episode was not going to end well. Either they were going to trump up charges against him to make him into the most evil person that had ever lived, or they would present arguments that Claudius had no idea what they were talking about. And I think that when once he was directed to be struck on the mouth, and he realized this was a kangaroo court, and it was not, he looked for a way of terminating it legitimately, and he did by making the statement that he did. And he knew the result that would happen, and that it, in effect, it brought everything, it started about as quickly as it stopped about as quickly as it started.
Well, that's true, and there are several elements, I think, in this that we're going to pursue. Carolyn?
We've talked in the different chapters about how Paul always looked at his audience and at what point was their knowledge. With the Jews, they knew all the history. With Gentiles, he took a different approach to preaching the gospel. And so in this case, I mean, he's got a presentation before a court, but it's yet another opportunity to preach the gospel. That's always his goal. And so where are these people coming from? So this is the hinge pin, to use your term, for them, is this whole resurrection business.
That's right.
It's a natural starting point.
I think that's right. That's where you've got to start. Now, in view of all that, this fellow Claudius Lysias, he's brought Paul before this court because he doesn't know what all this uproar is about. His background in the Jewish religion is woefully lacking because he's not a Jew. He's a Gentile. And he's a chief captain, which means he is a man of means. He's a man of rank among the Roman soldiers. We talked, I think, in our study on Wednesday night about the difference between a chief captain and a centurion. Here's a chief captain. A centurion is over how many soldiers?
100.
And how many is a chief captain over? 1,000. Now, we're going to see the reason for that as we pursue just a little bit further. But one of the things we do want to note just here, this man is a very important man. He is a very important man. He packs a lot of clout. And to keep peace in this city, he's trying to pursue the protocol that you would expect to take Paul before the Jewish court and so forth to settle this matter. But when the court becomes divided. Now, why did Claudius Lysias initially arrest Paul in chapter 21?
He's praying for his life.
Yeah, he's trying to save his life. Yes. Now, in this instance, if you'll note, beginning in verse 9, Acts 23, verse 9, it says, and there arose great clamor, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' part stood up and strove, saying, we find no evil in this man, and what if a spirit hath spoken to him or an angel? And when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should be torn in pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the castle. Two things I want us to see here. Number one is the attitude of the Pharisees. They just line up like this. I'm telling you, it's a political thing with them. Paul is a Pharisee. He's one of us. Yea, go Paul, you see. And so their attitude is, we don't find any evil in this man. Well, now, if you examine carefully what Paul has been affirming, they had found evil in him, because these leaders among the Jews have been responsible for some of these false charges. But now, because he's introduced something that they are politically in line with, we find no evil in this man. And so they're at odds with the Sadducees, their counterparts, as it were, in the court. And what if? You always want to be cautious when you read a statement that starts that way. What if? What if and a spirit hath spoken to him? Or an angel. Now, stop and ponder that for just a moment. Had the Lord already spoken to Paul? Had Paul said, the Lord has spoken to me? Yep. Uh-huh. Had the Lord spoken to Paul when he was in the temple in Acts chapter 22 on this visit to the city of Jerusalem? Well, yes. And had the Lord spoken to Paul while he was in Corinth in Acts chapter 18? Yes, verse 9. And now here he is in prison. And look, if you will, in verse 11 it says, "And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, Be of good cheer, for as thou hast testified concerning me at Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." Now, the Lord himself had spoken to Paul on a number of occasions. And what we want to note here is that the Pharisees are willing to grant some latitude that perhaps somebody real important from the spiritual world had been talking to Paul, because that's what they believed. They believed in spirits and they believed in angels. And we know that in times gone by we can read, for example, that angels spoke to men, both Old Testament and New Testament. So we know that the Pharisees had ample opportunity to know from the text that angels speak to men. And so be that as it may be. Now, let us underscore that angels don't speak to men today. Okay, that's another subject. But here we're talking about Paul's trial. And the Lord himself had spoken to Paul on numerous occasions after he had been crucified and raised from the dead. So the Pharisees are willing, based on the premise that they believed in the resurrection, to grant that maybe somebody has spoken to Paul. So now we've got the court so torn up that Claudius Lysias comes to the rescue of Paul again and orders the soldiers to bring him back to the castle. Now, several things we want to underscore on that relative to this second point I wanted to make. You remember our map of where Paul travels on his third preaching tour. And we've got him leaving. I don't have the map up here, but you remember the map. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Can you picture that in your mind? Most of you have seen this map many times. All right, we've got the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and the Dead Sea down here. All right? Now, Paul has been sent out by the church up here in Antioch of Syria, and he's made several journeys across over in this area, three journeys. And now on his third preaching tour, we find that Paul has been up in this area. You remember the map? Everybody seeing it? Okay, he's been up through Asia and on up into Macedonia and come down into Achaia there in Corinth, where he writes the Roman letter. And look at what he says in the Roman letter. In Romans chapter 15, I find this useful for so many purposes. You can back up, if you would like, all the way to verse 25 of this text and know why. We've discussed this already. Know why Paul is on his way to Jerusalem. The text tells us that he's on his way to Jerusalem with this collection from the churches in Macedonia and Achaia. And we know that the churches of Galatia had been contributed to it as well from 1 Corinthians 16. And we know that he's on his way to Jerusalem, right? To take this collection to minister to the needy saints in Jerusalem. Now, if you'll drop down in that text to verse 30. Paul now writing from Corinth. Get the timeline, get the map firmly fixed in your mind. This is before he gets to Jerusalem, the events that we're talking about now. But in verse 30 of Romans chapter 15, it says, "Now I beseech you, brethren, by our Lord Jesus Christ and by the love of the Spirit, that ye strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that are disobedient in Judea." Now, who would that be? The Jews in Judea. The unbelieving Jews in Judea. "That I might be delivered from them." Now, hold your finger right there. Question number one. Would that include that angry mob of Jews in Acts chapter 21? Yeah, when he arrived in Jerusalem? Yeah, that'd include them. Would that include the angry mob that heard his presentation in Acts 22? Yeah, that'd include them. Would that include this angry court that's about to tear him into pieces? Yes, it would include them too. Now, my question to you is this. Number two is, do you see Claudius Lysias in this context acting by the providence of God as an instrument to answer the prayers of these brethren?
Yes, no doubt.
No doubt. No doubt. He's called upon these folks to pray that he might be delivered from the unbelieving Jews. And look at Claudius Lysias. He's delivered him already two or three times, and he's not done yet. Now here's an important man, a soldier responsible for 1,000 men. You think he can keep Paul safe? Yes, he can. And he does. Now do you think when Paul calls upon these brethren in Rome to pray for him that he even knew who Claudius Lysias was? Unlikely. But here is his deliverer in response to the prayers of those brethren. Now you think prayer don't do anything?
I would even suggest that at this point in time when he penned this, he had not been begun to receive the prophecies saying that he was going to be bound when he went.
Oh, he had not.
I think that the way this whole letter reads, he's going to go to Jerusalem, deliver the contribution to the saints there, and then he's going to go to Rome.
Well, that's his plan. And his plan is to come on by them in Rome on his way to Spain. You'll see that in verse 28. So he anticipates coming to Rome at this point that he writes this.
He just didn't have the details.
Well, no.
Exactly right.
No, he didn't have the details. They weren't given yet. This evolves over a period of time. In fact, evolves over a period of years before it's finally satisfied as far as his prayers. The prayers of these brethren on his behalf. Does everybody see that? I think that's a powerful passage. When you talk about the power of prayer, here's a man in the position at the right time and used by God to do the very thing these brethren prayed for. Now, you can cite other examples of that. We've seen some in the Old Testament regarding the use of the king of Assyria, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, Cyrus, the king of the Persians, but God used these men as instruments in his hand to accomplish his purpose. And Paul's going to Rome.
You said what I was saying.
Okay. Yeah.
Randy? Specifically.
Yeah. He's going to Rome.
And I know that I've used this example before, but so often we have things that we ask God for. And then we, for instance, protect us today. And so you're driving down the street and somebody pulls out in front of you and they cut you off and you're really frustrated. But as it turns out, unbeknownst to you, if you had been continuing down the street, there would have been someone that would have run a red light and plowed into you on down the street. And that person just saved your life. And so often things happen to us and we are critical to God. And, if he could talk to us, he'd say, but you asked me to protect you, and so I did.
Yeah.
What should be?
Well, the wisdom writer said in Ecclesiastes that man does not know all of the things that God does. That's a brief paraphrase, but that's the point that's being established. And what we might note there is we have many examples of that. For example, I'm going to try to get back to this and not take off on the providence of God, because that's a subject I like to talk about. But when you think about the providence of God, you think about Joseph. Joseph was sold as a boy when he was about 17 years old, and he was down there in Egypt for 22 years. 22 years. Now, if you had a child that you didn't know where they were, but you had an idea that they were only about 200 miles away, would you go? Well, you see, Joseph's dad thought he was dead. He didn't know it was 200 miles away. And the thing involved in that is when you consider the providence of God, think of what happened to Joseph to bring him to that place in Egypt. You ever think about what if that caravan of travelers had been going north instead of south? He wouldn't have been in Egypt, but they were going south. What if Joseph's brothers liked him instead of hated him? He wouldn't have been sold. What if Joseph's daddy had not made a coat of many colors? His brothers might not have hated him so much. You see, and then you can just go down the list. What if Potiphar's wife had not tried to seduce Joseph? Well, he wouldn't have been in prison. And if he wasn't in prison, he wouldn't have met the butler and the baker to be able to explain to them their dreams. And when the butler was restored to his position of authority, what if he had remembered Joseph immediately? But he forgot all about it for 2 years. For 2 years, forgot all about it until Pharaoh had his dreams. And you can just go on down and down and down and down and down the list of things that occurred that Joseph said, "You meant that to me for evil, but God meant it for good to bring me to this place to save you alive this day." Now that illustrates these little things that occurred that we seemingly think of to be so insignificant, but nonetheless, these were evidence of God providing for his people through Joseph and all the events that brought him to Egypt. Then his people were saved alive. Another illustration, if you care for another one, is the book of Esther. An incredibly interesting, fascinating book when you study the book of Esther. The things that God did. And Mordecai raised the question, how do you know, Esther, when he asked her to go and appear before the king on behalf of people, how do you know that God has not brought you to this place for this very purpose?
Since I actually paid attention to the history and geography class, one of the biggest ones that I saw was when, even of course I can't remember what part, but when the queen went through and killed all the family that she had, and then it was just her son.
Yeah, oh, very good.
And had, like, in that one more death would have been the end of anything that God.
That's right. That's right. Very good. That would be Athaliah, who usurped the throne. She thought she killed everybody, but there was one little grandson that was preserved by the high priest, and he did not die. He brought him out when he was, 8 years old, I believe, and proclaimed him to be the king. Yeah, that would be Josiah?
Joash.
Thank you. You started with a J. Thank you. Okay, good. Very good. Now, next point in line, find where that is. I forgot. But be that as it may. Very good point. Very good point. All right. So then, the Apostle Paul says in this text that that's why I've been arrested. And we see the division that occurs. And we see Claudius Lysias once again coming to the rescue. Now, in the 11th verse, Acts chapter 23, verse 11, there it says, "And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, Be of good cheer. For as thou hast testified concerning me at Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." Now, Paul was promised that he would preach in Rome. Now, when you follow the events back, let's go back, if you will, again in the book of Acts to the 19th chapter. Acts, the 19th chapter. And drop down in that text to verse 21. Verse 21. Now, the incident here, and Randy, I probably need to correct something that I said a few moments ago regarding the timeline, whether or not Paul knew at the time that he wrote the Roman letter that he would be going to Rome. I may have implied, if not said, that maybe at that time he did not know, but this was before he wrote the Roman letter, and he is told that he's going to Rome. If you'll note in Acts chapter 19, in verse 21, it said, now this is in Ephesus, so we're in Asia now, before he arrives in Macedonia or Achaia. It says, now after these things were ended, Paul purposed in the Spirit, when he had passed through Macedonia and Achaia, to go to Jerusalem, saying, I have been there, or after I have been there, I must see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of them that ministered unto him, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. So I think that's helpful for us to see that he knew earlier that he was going to Rome. Is that doable?
Well, I think he planned to go to Rome.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
but the details he didn't know yet.
He didn't know. No, he didn't know. He had desired and planned to visit Rome. I think you see that in Romans chapter 1 and as he's writing from Corinth. That it's his intent and purpose to go to Rome. Okay. All right. Now then, beginning in verse 12, we begin something that I think is fascinating as well. There's my word again. Verse 12, it says, "And when it was day, the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. And they were more than 40 that made this conspiracy." I would suppose, folks, that they got hungry because they said, "We're not going to eat or drink until we've killed Paul." And they didn't kill Paul. Like I said, I would suppose that they got hungry over a period of time.
I have always maintained God has a sense of humor. I think you read about the seven sons of Sceva is one indication. I think this is enough.
Well, it is, and I think that when you read of bald-headed Elijah calling down those bear on those boys for making fun of his bald head, that's another interesting point along that line as well. But what we want to note here is that these men bind themselves under a curse that they're going to kill Paul. And there's 40 of them that are party to this plot. Now, you'll note in verse 14, it said that they came to the chief priest and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a great curse, a curse to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, do ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you, as though ye would judge of his case more exactly. And we, before he comes near, are ready to slay him." But Paul's sister's son, we'll talk about that in just a moment. But what I want you to note is there is a conspiracy. This band of 40 people, and we don't know who they were. They just are people that are determined to kill Paul. But they have every plan and purpose of involving the court and even involving Claudius Lysias in this plot to kill Paul. Because it would be Claudius Lysias, the chief captain, who would be responsible for his transportation from point A to point B. And here these men say, "We want you to do this." So they enter into this conspiracy, is the word that's used in verse 13, with the chief priest and the elders of the Jews. So we've got folks involved in the court that are part of this conspiracy.
I was going to say, it doesn't say that they agree, but it doesn't indicate that they disagree either.
No, well, they didn't have time to make a decision because, keep in mind, here it is at night, and Paul is hurried out of town before daylight.
They must have thought that it would be well received.
Yes.
To come up with that.
Yes, no doubt. But the kink in their armor, or chink in their armor, is Paul's nephew who found out about it. And, you know, it's kind of hard to keep 40 men quiet about anything. And they let this out, and Paul's nephew heard about it. And the text tells us that he had the opportunity to go. Now, again, I want to underscore this, that they are prepared to lie to the chief captain, to lie to him. Oh, is it time to quit? Well, I guess we ought to quit. We're out of time.